From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Emily Tamkin, U.S. editor for the New Statesman, Richard Lautendresse, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada, and our moderator is Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. U.S. President Donald Trump came under growing pressure to respond to stunning allegations that Russia offered bounties for killing American troops in Afghanistan. Democrats and Republicans are pushing for answers about what President Trump knew, when he knew it, and how he intends to respond. As COVID-19 cases reached record levels across the United States, National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases Director Dr. Anthony Fauci expressed concern that an infection rate of 100,000 new cases per day was a possibility if changes are not made. The surge in cases led to reversals of openings in many states and a long-awaited endorsement of mask wearing from the White House. China's parliament passed national security legislation for Hong Kong this week, setting the stage for the most radical changes to the former British colony's way of life since it returned to Chinese rule 23 years ago. Cities and states across the U.S. continued to see protests connected to the Black Lives Matter movement, with National Independence Day celebrations set for the coming weekend. Authorities are grappling with the problem of protecting the rights of peaceful protesters while maintaining safety for the general public. And we take a look at the power of symbols as flags and statues that represent violence and oppression in America come under scrutiny. Panelists, welcome, as we are via Skype yet again during COVID-19. We want to start off with Trump and Russia. Reporting from a number of sources revealed that Russia was offering cash bounties to Taliban fighters for killing American soldiers in Afghanistan. The reporting says that American intelligence knew of the bounties as far back as early 2019. Questions are now swirling about the quality of the intelligence, if and when the president knew, and if he didn't, why not? Emily, I'll start with you. What does the reporting say that the administration knew, and what was the earliest that they knew it? Because I think that's one of the more significant points, when this information actually came to light.
It was last year in 2019, and based on the reporting that I have seen, the president was not verbally briefed, but two separate publications have reported that this intelligence was put into the president's written briefing materials. So I think that now there's being some parsing of, well, what does it mean to be briefed? If the information is put into briefing materials, to my mind, that information is passed on to the White House for consumption and decision-making. Now, is it possible that those reports were wrong and it wasn't in the president's daily brief or it wasn't in his briefing materials? Sure. But I think given the White House's track record with denials, obfuscations, and flat-out lies, I personally would be hesitant before saying, well, the president says he wasn't briefed on this. That means he wasn't briefed.
Richard, the president immediately tweeted that Vice President Mike Pence and Chief of Staff Mark Meadows were not briefed. He made that almost verbatim statement that they weren't briefed. Intelligence officials who have experience working with the White House and working with issues like this of life and death with American lives on the battlefield, some have said that it's not credible. Some say that it's implausible. Your thoughts on that?
Well, the impression is that it really looks like it was part of the written briefing that the president was receiving. But when you have, like Tuesday, his press secretary insisting that he does read the briefs, it's interesting that they have to insist. It sounds more that the president listened to a vocal explanation. And according to the reports we can read, they've been understanding through the years that he doesn't like to hear about Russian intervention around the world or Russian threats to American interests. So they've minimized this aspect of the reports. What's also interesting, Michael, is that, you know, there's a pattern of rejection or at least minimizing the intelligence agency's conclusion since the beginning. All this, the impact of the Russian intervention in the 2016 presidential election, the president has constantly claimed that it's a hoax, and this time he comes back with this word. So there's a constant dynamic of not taking the word of the American intelligence agencies to what they're worth. And also, I just want to underline how interesting it is each time we hear these stories. And apparently, in late February, the president somehow more clearly was informed of this, and still at the White House himself in May, and with the postponement of the G7 summit, wanted to bring back Russia in the group. And still he was, you know, like sending signs of goodwill towards Moscow, which remains always interesting.
Emily, so you have the president saying that he was not briefed because he did not get this verbally. You also at the same time have his press secretary at the podium saying that the president does read, which would mean sort of by the transitive property that he did read this information if he read it. My question is whether he did know or he didn't know, which is worse for him, the fact that he would not have known about this or the fact that he did know and didn't do anything about it?
I'd like to pick option C, which is that both are bad in different ways, right? Because I think the worst of all, to my mind, would be if this information was in the written materials and the president couldn't be bothered to read the information that was put in front of him, right? Like if he at least read it and decided that the intelligence was, it wasn't credible or it hadn't been verified, or, you know, he couldn't take any action on it, that's one thing. One could say, oh, this is a pattern of the president not wanting to take action on against Russia, which would be confounding and problematic, but at least we could debate the decision. Mm-hmm. Whereas right now, I think we're still in this realm where it's possible that the president didn't bother to read his briefings.
Richard, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the following: I can assure you that whatever reporting it is that you're referring to, just speaking to reporters, that we responded in precisely the correct way. The fact that the Russians are engaged in Afghanistan in a way that's adverse to the United States is nothing new. We took this seriously. We handled it appropriately. If the president, the vice president, and the chief of staff, and apparently now the DNI director, Ratcliffe, also is saying that he was not aware, who is we taking the appropriate response?
It's a very good question, especially because we do not know either what was the appropriate response that was taken. Mike Pompeo, it's very interesting to read what he claims, because did he take the initiative since the president claims he was not informed, was not briefed, people around him? So was Mike Pompeo the one leading the charge against Russian activities in Afghanistan? So the president was not involved in this? It's very interesting.
Emily, now at this point, as we speak, the Democrats and Republicans in the House and Senate have been briefed, and apparently so has the president. What is the Democratic response, and has there been any Republican pushback on an issue that would have really set the party on fire in any other administration at any other time?
Two things on this. One, yes, there has been, I mean, there's obviously been Democratic pushback. I would be surprised if we did not have some sort of hearing or further briefings or some something from, especially from the Democratic controlled House. There have been Republicans in Congress who have said, yes, we were briefed on this. These intelligences have noted that they found it jarring. There have also been Republicans who have sort of danced around it or made excuses. And exactly as you say, had this happened, I mean, at this point, it's sort of trite to say, well, had this happened to the Obama administration, but this is the party that has made itself, has tried to present itself as the party of patriotism and the troops and the flag and America's power and prestige abroad. And when members of that same party make excuses for the president's handling of this issue, and even his statements around it, right? All he had to say was, I'm not going to comment on classified information. And instead, exactly as Richard said, he discredited the intelligence community.
Yeah, we've heard the terms, the intelligence is questionable and this is a hoax. Both of these terms sound familiar, but we'll wait for further reporting, which I'm sure will come in the days ahead. Let's shift to the COVID-19 situation in the United States. Dr. Anthony Fauci has signaled great concern about the surges that are taking part in, we can say now officially, most of the country. I believe 34 states are now in an uptick in cases. We'll go to you, Richard. Which states are being worst affected, and what steps are they now taking to sort of roll back this spike in coronavirus positive tests?
Well, we see a major increase in the South and in the West, Southwest, in states that were eager to reopen the economy, restart business: Texas, Arizona, Florida in the South, and California on the West Coast. What's interesting over there is that for a long time, there was this impression that it was described, not necessarily in California, but in Florida and Texas, as an exaggerated threat and response to something that could be contained differently. They opened restaurants and bars and public spaces, and from the moment you see this, then by extension, there is this increase of cases. Their reaction? Well, they're just going back. Florida, Miami-Dade County, we're getting close to 4th of July. Beaches are closed over there, which is a major way of showing people that this crisis is still very, very serious. But again, it's not the governor of Florida who's coming forward with these ideas. You know, there's this very, I would say nuance to be respectful, but I think I should be more critical way of presenting the increase in cases as it affects younger people, and there are far less deaths than there used to be. But it's apparently, according to experts, if we want to respect their judgment, it's just a question of time before we see a new uptick in death cases.
Emily, we haven't seen that uptick in fatalities, as Richard mentioned. Is that because the country is better prepared now for this, I would say, the second part of the first wave than it was in February and March?
No, I don't think we can say that we're better prepared. Fortunately, we haven't seen an uptick in deaths yet. I mean, it could be because there were some who have suggested, like, oh, the virus is gentler now. I don't know enough about the virus to speak to that at all, so I'm not going to. But what I will say is that even though there are not deaths, there are still, if people are still being hospitalized, that still puts strain on the health system. Further, the fact that you're not dead does not mean that you are not seriously suffering as a result of this virus. Some say that this virus could have ramifications that stay with you your entire life. So I just want to, I know that this isn't what Richard or you were saying, but I just want us to be clear that this is a serious uptick, even though the uptick in deaths hasn't happened yet. I mean, could it be because it's more young people going out and getting the virus? Yes, of course. There's all sorts of reasons. Part of what makes this virus so scary is that we're learning about it as we go, which is part of why it was important for the country as a whole to take it seriously from the beginning, which obviously we did not.
I would ask you, Richard, the experts, and I would say 99 out of 1,000, say that wearing a mask in public is one of the most effective ways of slowing the spread. But it seems that the issue has become tragically politicized. Where does the opposition to mask wearing live right now in the political world? And is there a way, or are we on a path to having mask wearing universally accepted in the United States?
Well, it sounds like it's going to be the best alternative to social distancing. Social distancing, physical distancing, seems to be extremely difficult for people to accept in the long run. People want to get together, they want to see each other, they want to talk to each other. So wearing the mask would be the best way to say, okay, you want to open places, well, you want to walk around, you want to use public transport, you have to wear a mask. It's just that the signal from authorities, especially from the White House, has been so weak on this very point. The president himself refusing to wear it in public. Now he's claiming that he's all fine with it. But in the end, if he had started earlier in different places, a lot more people would probably have used it. But indeed, the way especially the president was talking about it at first was almost described as a political statement against his administration. That was the way he was perceiving it. But now it's getting more and more used, and it's a good thing. And to go back to what Emily said, what fascinates me when I read about this virus is that they seem to be discovering new impact on mental health, not just the fact of being confined, but just like being hit by the virus has an impact not only on your lungs and on your organs, but even on your brain. Now that we see an increase in hospitalization in 12 states, in hospitals in Miami and Houston being overwhelmed with cases to the point where they have to put non-urgent elective surgeries on the side, you can see how, again, this is going, we're going to talk about this, Michael and Emily. I feel just like we did beginning of April, just being overwhelmed by the reality.
Well, so much more to say on that subject, but we do have to take a break. We'll be back with more of Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype, Emily Tamkin, U.S. Editor for the New Statesman, Richard Lautendress, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada, and our moderator, Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. Before we get started, I want to mention that our Emily Tamkin, I believe, has a new book called The Influence of Soros. And I believe, Emily, that is to be released very soon. Is that correct?
It's out July 7th. Yes, that's correct.
July 7th. Well, congratulations to you. And I look forward to receiving a signed copy.
Yes, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Let's move on to Hong Kong. China's parliament passed national security legislation for Hong Kong this week, rolling back most of the provisions that were made for any semblance of independence in the original passover from Great Britain to independence and to Chinese control. Emily, I'll look with you first. The key provisions in the legislation really just call for the ending of the protests that we've seen for the last, I guess, over 12 months in Hong Kong, correct?
That's correct. So what the law claims to do is criminalize secession, subversion of state power, collusion with foreign entities, terrorism. Those now carry a penalty of up to life in prison, so it makes protest much more dangerous. The other really striking thing about this law is that, other than the fact that Beijing is now setting up its own national security agency in Hong Kong, which reports back to Beijing, the law applies to anyone anywhere in the world. It says that it can apply offenses committed outside the region by a person who's not a permanent resident of the region. So basically what that means is that if you write or say or do anything that's perceived as being against China anywhere in the world, should you then go to Hong Kong, one would imagine that you might face repercussions for it. There have already been arrests made under this law. There have already been protesters saying, I need to lay low for a while. There have also already been protesters taking back to the streets. In some ways, it's not a dramatic turn of events because this has been building, this has been coming. But the law itself is so dramatic to say that, oh, well, it's just business as usual, would not do credit to the momentous nature of this legal action.
And Richard, it seems as though China has taken advantage of the chaos that's going on in the world with COVID-19 and taken these steps when leaders have their hands full. Let's face it, with domestic issues regarding the health and safety of their own citizens. What has, though, been the response of the world to this development?
Well, there's been major objections from Western capitals about this issue constantly. And this is what is actually interesting. It shows first how Beijing not only wants to go ahead in this case towards the protesters, but Beijing doesn't really care about the rest of the world criticizing its policies. So there are two dimensions in there. It's the attitude of the Chinese authorities absolutely not being bothered by what is being said and done outside of China, and the weakness of our answers. It could be linked to the fact that we're just focusing essentially our energy and money and whatever we have to do towards fighting this virus, but also through the years, because of the way the economy has developed and globalization giving a huge place to Chinese manufacturing, there's far less strength in the rest of the world influence on Chinese decision like this.
It seems as though the openness, the opportunity, the very nature of Hong Kong has been undercut by this. And many are saying that this is really the end of Hong Kong as we know it. And we'll, of course, keep our eye on developments. Let's go back to the U.S. and talk about the ongoing protests for racial justice that have been going on over a month now. With U.S. Independence Day on July 4th, officials are preparing for this mixture of celebrations and protests that's certain to happen on the streets of the cities and towns in the U.S. In Seattle, for example, an area of the city that had been commandeered by protesters for weeks was cleared by police in advance of this day. Similar areas exist in Atlanta and other cities. Emily, what is the mood and momentum of the protests now? As they say, it's been over a month. What's the mood now in most of the protests?
First of all, I think it's important to note, as you have, that these protests are ongoing. I think that as they continued, some mainstream media sort of moved on to cover other things, which is on the one hand understandable but because of the nature of news cycles. But on the other hand, the protests are against police brutality and systemic violence against Black Americans, which obviously has not gone away in the last month. So they continue. You know, I think in terms of this, well, you know, we want peaceful protests, but people have the right to be safe. These protests have been largely peaceful, particularly as they have gone on. And if we're marking Independence Day, it is not unreasonable to want to also mark some of the hypocrisies of that Independence Day, like slavery and the subsequent racial inequality that continues in this nation to this day. So I just think that it's important to not privilege the 4th of July and American history over the well-being of Americans, not just the well-being in terms of physical safety, but in terms of the full equality of Americans and their right to protest in the present.
Very well said. Richard, there's a clear divide that's on display in the United States between a so-called, let's say, law and order faction that is led by the president of the United States, and he makes these feelings known through his statements and his tweets and other methods, and also this group that wants to affect change through civil unrest, through civil demonstration, this culture war that's being created by the president, fanning the flames. Let's go to the Trump Twitter account. What effect do his tweets have? What are they meant to have, and what effect are they having? Let's go intent versus impact.
Well, we can believe that he sees this as a way to energize his base, excite it, make sure that they're watching what is happening around the country and they're not focusing on aspects of his administration that are not going as well as expected, especially the state of the economy. I think the president wants, insists so much on law and order because there are not that many other handles he can grab to tell his people, yes, I need to be reelected. Otherwise, the other aspect of his law and order argument is to say the anarchists and the extremists and the vandals are behind the extreme left Democrats and Joe Biden. So he's portraying law and order as what could happen if anybody else were to replace him, or to the Democrats, of course, in the White House. What I found interesting, and in this, it's in the spirit of what Emily was also saying, Michael, I just want to say that for all the times where we say, oh, the U.S. influence around the world has gone down because of this administration or because of all sorts of reasons, you can see how much, and I think it's very interesting to know, to underline it, that how much the rest of the world has been questioning its own policing practice, the way the police is acting on it on their streets, questioning it. In some places it's been working well, but in other places they've noticed, and I can tell you, even here in Canada, we have been going through systemic racism, even if we see our country as more balanced with less tensions and of course a different history, a different racial history, because of what happened after the death of George Floyd on May 25th and the civil unrest and the tensions. You know, the U.S. remains a reference for people to start reviewing things. And too often, I think we were disappointed or with what has been lost in American influence around the world.
And I'll give you the last word on this in terms of this culture war, because an interesting part of it is that now statues and flags that commemorate the American Civil War have ignited a 21st century culture war. So you have Department of Homeland Security deploying a special federal unit to protect federal monuments and statues over this weekend. And then you have protesters who are trying to literally take those statues and flags down. How did they become so significant? And is this really a key issue for us, these symbols?
I think I want to say three things. The first is that support for Black Lives Matter, including with Republicans, has and sort of support for the cause of combating police brutality has dramatically increase just this year. Second, that according to polls, and which, you know, can lie or can be wrong or can change, people want to see a president who pursues racial unity more than they want a president who uses law and order to secure the security of the country, at least right now. That could change in November. But the third thing that I want to say is that if you, listener, are using a Confederate monument as a symbol of the United States and saying that those who would tear them down are opposed to the United States and to American history and are anti-American, I would invite you to consider that it was those who fought in the Confederacy who were trying to break down the nation. And so perhaps what you are actually saying is that you want to leave up these monuments to slavery and to those who fought for slavery, and just take a moment and think for yourself about what that means about your understanding and appreciation of race relations in America historically and today.
Well, I'll just end with this note from primary congressional elections that happened this week, where Jamal Brown in New York State, Jamal Brown, an openly gay African-American man, defeated his fellow Democrat, 30-year-plus Congressman Elliot Engel, while in Colorado in a Republican primary, a proponent of far right-wing conspiracy theories beat out Donald Trump's chosen candidate. That tells me that these culture wars are far from over. That's all the time we have for this week. Thanks to Emily Tamkin, U.S. editor for The New Statesman, and Richard Latendresse, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada. This program is produced by Voice of America, and I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.